The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Before we start today's podcast, I want to tell you about a new exciting program called Rewire You. It's Second City's take on professional development, using the skills of improvisation to navigate an ever-complex and challenging business world with greater authenticity and resilience. More importantly, we have partnered with the Chicago Booth School at the University of Chicago to infuse the program with cutting-edge research from the world of behavioral science. Rewire You is great for current and future leaders who want to get more from themselves and their teams. You can find out more at secondcity.com/rewireu. Classes begin soon. Welcome to the Second City Works, Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation for the world-famous Second City Theater. This is more than just a podcast. It's about getting to the yes and moment in your work and in your life. Yes and is a key pillar of improvisation. It operates at the front end of creativity. It's about building on ideas and navigating change. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tie and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Tina Seeley. Tina is professor of the practice in the Department of Management Science and Engineering at Stanford, where she is also executive director of the Stanford Technology Ventures Program. She is the best-selling author of many books, including What I Wish I Knew When I Was 20, Ingenious, and Insight Out. In 2009, Tina was awarded the prestigious Gordon Prize from the National Academy of Engineering for her pioneering work in engineering education. Tina, welcome to Getting to Yes And.
It's my pleasure. Thank you so much.
So we're going to dig deep into your latest book, Insight Out. But before we do that, I want to start with a quote from your previous book, Ingenious, where you write, quote, "Many people question whether creativity can be taught and learned. They believe that creative abilities are fixed, like eye color, and can't be changed. They think that if they aren't currently creative, there is no way to increase their ability to come up with innovative ideas. I couldn't disagree more," end quote. I love that.
Great. Let's dive in.
Yeah.
I feel passionate about this.
So the premise, it's not even the premise of this podcast, but it keeps coming up that creativity isn't magic. And the people who are trying to control it like that are only trying to put dollars in their pocket. And I think that's something you might agree with.
I certainly agree. And I think you can compare it to other disciplines, right? We would never say that you can't teach math or English or sports or music. I mean, why would we possibly say that you can't teach people to be more creative? It just is baffling. I think people use it as an excuse to not be creative. It's sort of like, oh, I'm not creative, like I'm not tall. And I think that we need to really reverse that trend.
Yeah. And the one of the things I love, too, is the constructs in both your books. You create these sort of building blocks. And one of them is the innovation engine, which is a combination of knowledge, imagination, and attitude, as well as resources, habitats, and culture. And what I love about, and we can't see it over the radio, but the way that these all intersect, they are not hierarchical.
Well, I have to tell you, I don't know if you know this, but because I've talked about it in some of my presentations, when I started that book, I didn't have that framework in mind. And it was only when I got to the end and it looked like a big jumble of things that I had to step back and look at it from a different perspective and realize that there actually were some very clear relationships between all the things that actually impact how creative we are.
Yeah, so in many ways, the skeleton came after you did the first draft?
Exactly. I really was very frustrated when I got to the end of the first draft of the book, and I really was going to throw it away. I thought this wasn't useful at all. And it was actually my husband who said, maybe there's some way that you can create a framework that holds us together. And so it was fascinating to watch this framework come to life as I kept playing around with all the pieces. It was like pieces of Legos, and finally they all snapped into place. And it you know, all models are wrong, obviously, but at least they give us some way to look at the material in some way that can be useful.
What's really funny about that is my experience of writing my book was the opposite, which is we had all this rich pedagogy from the world of improv that was right there. My editor was like, where are your stories? And it was like, we didn't have enough stories. And I'm like, oh, okay. Because that's where this stuff intersects. And I think with your second book, not your second book, but Inside Out, this invention cycle is really important. I think the order is somewhat important too, because you put it imagination, creativity, innovation, and entrepreneurship. And I think what you're suggesting is that while these things might intersect, they really are they go in order, because you can't get to creativity without first living inside imagination.
Well, here's what happened. I had been teaching classes for 15 years at Stanford on creativity and innovation. One of my classes is called Creativity and Innovation. And at some point I realized that I was doing a lot of hand waving around these definitions, and that if I asked everybody in the room to define these terms, we got a lot of different answers. And as a scientist myself, I mean, you know, I have my PhD in neuroscience, I realized that this type of loose thinking would never be tolerated in any other discipline. Why do we allow it in this world of innovation and entrepreneurship? And so I decided to put a stake in the ground and to create a set of definitions and relationships that would be helpful to me. And so once I started putting this together and talking to people who were innovative and were entrepreneurial, it became clear that even though people did not use the terminology in exactly the same way, this was actually the process they were using. And so to me, it felt as though it was really meaningful, because other people could start seeing the magic that goes on behind the scenes when someone's actually coming up with a really fresh idea.
Wow. I did not know about about the neuroscience, because that makes perfect sense. Because I was thinking about it, one of the things that happens in beginning improvisational classes is we offer that you really need to focus on your focus, that the focus of the individual is incredibly important, and focus outside the individual. And you quote a thought leader, Greg McKeown, who says, quote, "The word focus can be both a verb and a noun. This distinction is important, since success isn't just the act of focusing, but also selecting the right thing on which to focus."
Exactly. In fact, one of the most powerful things that I teach in my classes is about how to shift your focus in a meaningful way, because often we're not answering the right question. And one of my favorite concepts, and I don't know if I made it up or found it somewhere else, but I use it all the time, is the concept of framestorming, and having a framestorm before you brainstorm, so that you actually spend a considerable amount of time thinking about whether you're focusing on the right thing. I mean, let me just give you a super simple example, right? If you came to me and said, let's do a brainstorm on the best way to cure cancer, it's going to be a totally different set of solutions than if you're looking at ways to prevent cancer.
Right.
Right. So if you really have to think about, which of these am I trying to solve for? And maybe you're looking at the wrong thing.
Yeah. My colleague, Tom Yorton, he said this so many times, it got annoying to the rest of us, was what problem are you trying to solve?
Exactly.
Because you end up down this road. And one of the I think we're doing it to ourselves. Right. You know, it's like the myth of multitasking. I think a lot of people think they're really good at multitasking, and that's not the case. Right.
Oh, absolutely not. And I think that in today's world, we are so, well, you know, the media is there trying to get your attention. You know, look at me, look at me, look at me. In fact, I recently took all of my social media off my phone.
Yep.
It doesn't mean I don't use it if I'm sitting in front of my computer and I decide I want a distraction, but I don't want during the day for me to be even tempted. I want to be really focused and present on what's going on.
Yeah, I'm a total addict. There has been a theme in the last few tapings that we've done around digital addiction. And I keep coming home and talking to my wife, who just laughs at me. She's like, you know, you're the worst. I'm like, yes, I know. But this is making me focus. And you actually have a great quote. And the book is filled with all these great insights from so many different people. And it's from a tech entrepreneur who said, the most important part of being a leader is managing your own psychology.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is something, again, that you can practice, right? I'm fascinated all the time when my students are struggling with these these things, and then I realized, well, listen, I'm a lot older than they are, mm-hmm. and guess what? You know, I still struggle with them. These are lifetime projects to sort of manage your own psychology. Manage, one of the things I think about a lot is not just managing what you're doing, but managing what you're thinking about. That's one of the biggest wasted resources, yeah. is what we're thinking about. If I spend my time, you know, perseverating on some mistake I made yesterday or some, you know, the fact that I tripped and fell, as opposed to looking forward and thinking, what can I be using my mind share for in a useful way?
Yeah, totally. And, you know, while improvisation has aspects of it that are sort of people hacks that get you to, you know, shift your focus, you have some examples inside the book. And the one that blew me away was the designer, Mauricio Estrella. Can you tell that story? Because I marveled at this story.
This is a story with the passwords, right?
Yep.
So I haven't looked at it in a while, but it's totally brilliant because this is a fellow who had some very he was having a lot of struggles in his life, mm-hmm. and one of them is he was actually getting annoyed that where he worked he had to constantly be changing his password for his computer, and he decided to take that problem of I have to constantly change my password and use it actually for inspiration. And so what he did is his passwords were always messages to himself about something he wanted to accomplish, like quitting smoking or raising enough money to go on a vacation or getting over his ex-wife. And because he had to type these many times a day to get into his company's computer system, they essentially worked their way into his psyche, and he was able to, during the month he had to use that password, accomplish every single one of those goals.
He literally changed his password to get over his failed marriage to forgive her.
Yeah.
I mean, I was this was mind blowing to me because you know it we have to type this in so many times, and I think that certainly I know this to be true that I can think whatever I want, but when I do in a certain way, and sometimes that's speaking and sometimes it's typing or whatever, that makes the transformation in the behavior change.
So one of my favorite exercises that I give my students is I have them write failure resumes. And the idea is that they have to capture their biggest screw-ups, personal, professional, academic. And it's an incredible tool because it allows you, even if you don't even write it down, to when you mess up, to say, okay, that's another line on my failure resume. What did I learn from it? And move on. To me, it's been a really powerful tool because it allows you a place. It's like whether it's the password you type in or your failure resume, a place to actually hold those things and then move on to something else.
So that makes me think of the director McNapier at Second City invented a thing called Taboo Day, which is you have to bring in a scene idea that there's no way in hell Second City would ever allow it to be on the stage. And invariably, those scenes end up getting into the show.
Isn't that great? Okay, so this is exactly the thing I do with my students. Mm-hmm. Iconic exercise I do is to have the students brainstorm the worst idea they can for a new restaurant or a family vacation or a new product. And then we take these, they have to pick the worst of the worst ideas, and uh-huh. we give it to another team.
Uh-huh.
And that team has to turn it into something brilliant. And the fascinating thing is within 10 seconds, they see that there's a spark of genius in it.
Uh-huh.
And you realize that, again, this was a framing issue. When the team thought it was a bad idea, they were going to throw it out. When they had to look at it through the lens of possibilities, something amazing happened. And the really interesting piece is if I had given them the assignment to come up with the best ideas instead of the worst, I promise you, and I can prove it, those ideas are going to be really simple and really incremental.
Yeah.
Because when you have to come up with a good idea, there's a pressure for it to be good.
Right. I mean, we talk about the power of discomfort and the idea that creativity emanates out of discomfort, because at Second City we see this time and time again. And we're just, you know, now in terms of our partnership that we've recently done with the Booth School at University of Chicago, we're going to measure that. And literally, you know, from the classroom, measure people who are instructed to work inside of uncomfortable premises where they know that that's the thing, and other people who are not instructed in such and see what succeeds.
Great. I'd love to hear how that goes.
I'll let you know. Okay. I also want to talk about what you discuss in the book about sort of life at work. And this is a fantastic quote, and I actually shared it with my boss, and he loved it, which is, when you get a job, any job, you aren't just given that job, but rather the keys to the building. It's up to you to decide where they will take you.
You know, it's so funny that you repeat that now. Hmm. I just got an email this morning from a student of mine who heard me say that in a talk, and she told me that she then passed that on to she was a PhD student, to an undergrad that she was mentoring, and how this so resonated with them. So I think this is one of the most critical things for us to absorb in our lives, is that possibilities abound in every situation, and when you get a job, the minimum thing you do is the job that you were given. Yeah. And if you just do the job you were given, you've essentially communicated to everyone, well, that's, you know, you're good at that job. But if you really use it as an opportunity to see lots of places where you can contribute, the sky's really the limit.
Yeah, I think that in many ways our education drives our personal agency away at times. And I know that you have a, I'm actually going to tie a second quote of yours because I think they're complementary, even though they seem opposite. Another quote you said is, companies are blind to opportunities that don't fit in within the artificial borders they build around their business. So we really do. We can accomplish anything when we put our mind to it, but we have to, you know, individuals inside the business. I often say this to people at Second City. It's not your job to protect Second City. You know, it's your job to act with agency inside your position and try to lift all of us with your ideas and with your actions.
I couldn't agree more. And you talked at the beginning about our education system beating this out of us. I mean, the biggest problem, I think, in the education system is testing. Right. And some things are really easy to test. I can test if you know the sum of 5 + 5.
Yep.
And there's one right answer, and I can say you passed this test. But most things in life are very difficult to measure, and therefore we often don't teach those things, and we don't encourage those things. So one of my favorite examples of this is, I could ask you the sum of 5 + 5, you'll tell me 10, but could you teach that same math concept in a very different way where you would have multiple answers?
Mm.
And, you know, you can noodle on it for a minute, and I argue that if you ask a question, what two numbers add up to 10, it's the same math concept, but you now have an infinite number of solutions.
Right.
And that's really what life is about. When you get to a job, rarely do people give you an assignment that what's the sum of 5 + 5. You know, they don't tell you, go take this piece of paper and move it over here. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a rare situation. Most of the time we're told, get to 10, right? Figure out how to sell this product.
Yeah.
Figure out how to make this work. Design a website. And we have these very open-ended problems, and yet we don't prepare people for that.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. And what I know is true among the sort of CEO class is they don't necessarily care how you got there, and they don't even care necessarily how the equation all adds up, as long as it does add up, which means that you can color outside those lines.
One of my favorite metaphors that helps explain this is that are you a puzzle builder or a quilt maker? You know, puzzle builders are people who have very specific guidelines and have a very specific deliverable, you know, complete this puzzle. But if you're missing a piece of a puzzle, you can't complete it.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the people who have lots of excuses why things can't get done. Oh, that person is on vacation, the part is out of stock, lots of excuses. But if you see yourself as a quilt maker, your job is to look at all the resources that are available to you to figure out how to get to the desired outcome.
That's great. Yeah. No, and also because the puzzle is passive.
Exactly, and you're just being responsive to what someone else's vision.
I had a really funny interaction this morning with my daughter, who's in eighth grade, and they've been studying the Civil War, and they were supposed to spend one day on Lincoln, but Carol Trigiano, her teacher, is obsessed by Lincoln, so they've done like 5 days on it. And she was bemoaning the fact that at the last minute, she wanted them to all remember the dates of the battles. And Nora's like, well, you know, I can look this up, you know, and we all know that, and we've discussed that. And I said, I think it's to balance the fact that at the end of the day, you guys are all going to watch the movie Lincoln, that you actually get to sit for 3 hours and watch a piece of art as part of your education. And I think both things are important, right? There's a point to having sort of fixed knowledge, and there's another point to just sort of experience art as a way to learn.
Yeah, it's an interesting question of, you know, what facts do you need to know? Or did you have to know at one time?
Yeah.
Right? Knowing the dates probably at some point is important to put it in a historical context.
Yep.
So when you hear something else, you'd go, wow, you know, that was at the same time that Lincoln was president.
Yeah.
So memorizing them for the sake of memorization doesn't make sense, but understanding what else might be going on at that time would be really useful.
Yeah, that's what I thought, because I was actually cheating and looking. I tried to see if I knew any of the dates, which I didn't, but was close enough that I could guess the sort of time frame. You have another line in the book, resistance to your ideas is actually a gift.
I totally believe that.
All right, talk about that.
Well, I had a situation once years ago. It was when I first started teaching, and a student raised her hand at some point. You know, we were talking about sort of begging for forgiveness instead of asking for permission, this sort of stuff. And she said, you know, my parents desperately want me to go and get a job in consulting, and I really want to take a year off and travel around the world. Mm-hmm. And I had to think about how was I going to answer, and I realized, wow, resistance to your ideas is so powerful because it allows you to test the strength of your convictions.
Mm.
If you're constantly bowled over by other people's vision for you, you're missing the opportunity to really see how strongly you believe something. If I have a business idea that makes no sense to someone else, I might, though, have that wisdom and that vision, and maybe I'm seeing around the corners that they can't see around. I mean, I think of the number of times in which, you know, I've seen other people and even in my own life where I've had a vision for something and other people don't agree. In fact, I think about when I was in grad school, I started graduate school back east, mm-hmm. and I came out to California for vacation. And I said, oh, my gosh, I have to live here.
Hmm.
It just felt like I was home. And I went back home to my parents in New Jersey, and they were appalled. I mean, beyond appalled.
Hmm.
That I was going to drop out of graduate school that I had just started and move out to California and have no idea what I was going to do. But I knew that I needed to be somewhere else. I knew I needed a break. I knew it was going to be okay. And even though it was hard, I went way against what they wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And ended up being the best decision I ever made. And I'm reminded of that all the time, that resistance to your ideas is important, because it allows you to know how important something is to you.
Yeah, Adam Grant talks about a little bit of that in his last book, too. And it also speaks to, like, inventing things that people don't need versus also, you know, inventing the right thing. And I certainly understand in our work that it is from the tension that a lot of the great work actually emanates. But it's also, and you talk about this with the idea of pretotyping, which is a word I've never heard, but I think it's
a brilliant concept.
Yeah. I think it's very improvisation. Abundance early, right?
Right. So this concept was designed and discussed by my wonderful colleague Alberto Savoia, who started two companies, one that basically went like a rocket ship and they sold it for $100 million, and the next one that totally crashed and burned.
Hmm.
And he's an engineer at heart, and he really wanted to know what happened. And he came up with the realization that you can build something right but not have it be the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that how can you do super early, quick experiments to see if you're working on the right problem in the first place. So the idea is that a prototype tests if something will work, and a pretotype tests if you're working on the right thing. And so here would be a simple example that he would use. Let's say McDonald's wanted to sell Mac Spaghetti.
Mm.
Mac Spaghetti. And you could have opinions. Well, that would be smart. That would be stupid. Nobody knows.
Mm-hmm.
What is the smallest experiment you could do that would test to see if anyone was interested in this idea?
Put it in one store?
What's that?
Put it in one store?
Actually, you have to make spaghetti. No, you want to make it. Like, what is the easiest thing?
Yeah.
Easiest thing. Tiniest experiment that you could do in 10 minutes.
What is it?
What if you just put it on the menu?
Oh, put it on the menu before you even made it. Oh, we do that. I do that at Second City.
And if they ordered, you go, oh, I'm sorry, that is, you know, we're out of stock, but, you know, here, have some extra fries. But you can do get some data.
Sure.
You know, the idea is that you want the lowest amount of time to the most data as possible.
Okay, so here's the equivalent of that. I have done this repeatedly, and people think I'm insane, but they know I'm not now, is I will announce a show title that we haven't written.
Great. Perfect. Brilliant.
And it's essentially like, is it going to sell? Great. And since most shows happen a year after you announce them, you have plenty of time to build it. But, you know, essentially, if you can contextualize this experience, it's like Second City. We did it with, you know, Second City's Christmas Carol, where it was sort of like, oh, yeah, I get it. Second City's doing Christmas Carol. I'll buy tickets to that. Great. Then we'll write the show.
Perfect. Perfect example. And there are lots of different ways to do prototypes. One of my favorite examples comes from Jeff Hawkins, who invented the Palm Pilot and Handspring, and he's just totally brilliant guy. He knew he could build the Palm Pilot. He knew that he had the technology. He just didn't know if anyone would want it. So you know what he did? Hmm. He made a small block of wood, the form factor of the Palm Pilot, and he carried it in his pocket for several weeks. And every time there was, you know, an event or he needed to call someone, he'd pull out of his pocket and he had a little, you know, pin or a pencil or something, and he'd pretend he was working, you know, putting the date in or adding something to the calendar. And he wanted to see how he would use it and if he'd want to carry it around. So very quickly he realized, you know what, actually I would use this, and here are the things I'd use it for.
Wow. Yeah, that's what we do.
Right.
There is kind of a lovely practicality that both demystifies what creativity is, but also recognizes that it isn't easy. And you quote Mark Runco and Garrett Yeager at the University of Georgia, who say that, quote, creativity requires both originality and effectiveness. Originality is vital for creativity, but it is not sufficient. Original things must be effective to be creative.
So it's interesting. You know, there are so many people who have tried who have defined creativity in lots of different ways. And do you mind if I share the way that I think about it?
I'd love it.
So the invention cycle that you mentioned that, you know, that I describe in my last book, really is that's the major focus of the book. And I realized that we needed to start with imagination. And the idea is that imagination is envisioning things that don't exist. And then I define creativity as applying your imagination to solve a problem. So essentially, it's just applying your ability to envision things that don't exist to solve a problem. Now, that doesn't mean it's unique to the world, right? So I could reinvent a peanut butter sandwich. That might be creative, but it's not innovative, because innovation is the next stage, which is applying my creativity to come up with a unique solution. And we often conflate the terms creativity and innovation.
Right.
And it's so powerful to differentiate, because then when you and I are talking and we're working on and we want to come up with a breakthrough idea, we go, wait, that was great. That was a really creative idea. Let's push further and make it really innovative. And then the next stage is entrepreneurship. And entrepreneurship is applying the innovation to bring things to the world and to scale them. And so what I'd like to do is compare it to learning to talk. And the idea is that babies naturally babble. They apply those sounds to make words. They apply the words to make sentences and the sentences to make stories. And that same sort of hierarchy applies. Going from sounds to words to sentences to stories is the same process as going from imagination to creativity to innovation to entrepreneurship.
Okay. So as you're doing this, I'm writing down the four stages of how we create a review at Second City.
Okay, great.
So day one, six people are in a room with the director. They have nothing. And they start getting on their feet and they start improvising content. At night, they then put that material into the show to test it in front of an audience who, by their laughter or lack thereof, turn that material into scenes that stay or scenes that go. And then they open the show. And from the opening, all the different things kick in, like marketing and reviews and all the things that turn it commercial. But it is a very deliberate process that starts with nothing, that works with sort of an abundant amount of ideas that may or may not work, that we sort of prototype and then roll into something, and then it's commercialized.
Yes. And I think you could break it down into this process. Now,
yeah.
One of the things that I did that were really meaningful to me and to my students is that you then can look at what actually has to happen at each stage. And I think you do all of this very naturally. Mm-hmm. The imagination stage requires engaging in the world and envisioning what might be different. So you, during that initial brainstorming process, mm-hmm. are probably reading the newspaper.
Yes.
Or walking down the street. You're mm-hmm. paying attention.
Mm-hmm.
You bring all those ideas to the table, right?
Yep.
So you're engaged in the world, and then you envision what might be different.
Yep.
You then go into the creativity stage, which requires motivation and experimentation, right? You're now motivated to figure out some way to take that problem and shape it, and you start experimenting by coming up with lots of ideas.
Yeah, make it a scene and then improvise it in front of an audience.
Exactly.
Yep.
The innovation stage is now you're going to push it further. This requires focus. You now
fine-tuning.
Go, okay, this is the one we're going to really work on.
Yep, yep.
And now you're reframing it. You're going to start questioning and pushing it further.
Mm-hmm.
And then the entrepreneurship stage is really great. It takes grit or sort of persistence, inspiring others. And the inspiration and inspiring others is essentially the storytelling piece. Now you're going to get out there and you're trying to, you know, inspire other people with what you've done.
Yeah, and what's so great about your structure and looking at our structure is that if you take away any of those, I don't think it works.
Exactly.
Certainly not the commercial.
One of the things that's super important, though, mm-hmm. is that the end leads back to the beginning, right?
Yes.
You now take the data from that experience. It leads back into the next time you go around, because now you bring that data back to the imagination stage that allows you to do the next one even better.
Yeah.
And it's a whole iterative process.
Yeah. One of the reasons I loved your book is that I had not seen this level of sort of gritty specificity laid out about the creative process. And it doesn't, you know, and I know talking, you know, it's like dissecting a dead frog, right? The idea of talking about this stuff. But it is important because creativity can be learned and practiced, and it is too often held away from us. And it's the lifeblood, I think, of everyday activity.
But I think it's really important to understand that it's also a skill. It's not just knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
It's the difference between my understanding the rules of chess and mm-hmm. being able to tell you how the pieces move and actually learning how to become a chess player.
Right.
Or knowing the rules of baseball and learning how to actually hit the ball with the bat.
Yeah.
And so it takes practice. And one of the problems people have is that they learn the rules, and then they say it doesn't work. Well, you would never say that chess doesn't work, you know, because I am not a chess master instantly. And you wouldn't say baseball doesn't work because, you know, I can't connect with that ball.
Right.
The fact is this takes a lot of practice in order to actually master it.
Yep. I was finishing up one of the chapters in your book, and I was on Well Street at Second City looking across the street at Walgreens. And I don't know if you know this, that's the Walgreens where the Tylenol...
The scare.
Which a lot of people don't know about, by the way, young people don't know about. And you talk about that in your book in terms of a powerful story of reframing.
Yeah, and recovering from failure, right?
Yeah.
I mean, how Tylenol, that was, you know, a very scary time when all of a sudden people had tampered with Tylenol bottles and some people got poisoned and died.
Yep.
So how does the company deal with that? When you could go out of business
mm-hmm.
with that type of press.
Mm-hmm.
And how they used that as an opportunity to quickly show how they were responsive, how they changed their packaging, and they demonstrated that this was something they really, really cared about and that they weren't obviously going to tolerate this in any way. And so it ended up increasing our trust of the company as opposed to decreasing it by looking at their response.
Yeah, it was really amazing. So that happened in 1982.
Yeah, and it's the iconic story of dealing with crises in businesses.
Totally. We're coming close to the end, and I'm going to ask you for a yes and story. But before I do that, a slight experiment. I don't know why I thought of you, but I did on Thursday night. I was part of I did a keynote before a workshop that we did for 25 senior business consultants at this like Brazilian themed bar in the back lobby. And the overall goal was to stress interpersonal communication as a thing to be worked on and developed, but not assumed. So one of the exercises that Megan and Becca, my colleagues at Second City Works, led was they got two people in conversation, but they for the conversation, they had to spell out their words. So if they wanted to say, you know, W-H-Y-A-R-E-Y-O-U, and then the other person had to respond. And then when afterwards, and there was a lot of sort of commotion as it was being done, we were asking for what people thought. And they're like, it was frustrating. It was hard. It was confusing. And two things we sort of talked about was this idea of the ability then to adjust the conditions. So what did you do to make it easier? And some people are like, well, shorter sentences. I slowed down. I had to get rid of the noise and focus more. But the bigger takeaway that I think everyone got was we assume good listening.
Mm-hmm.
And that assumption is terrifically wrong.
I agree.
Okay. that's what I thought. Because I was finding that in your book that over and over again, it's that we've made the presupposition is false. And then if the presupposition is false, everything afterwards is not necessarily going to be true or work.
Yes. And in fact, the whole creative process is predicated on paying attention. And the more you can pay attention, the more you notice things. You're going to notice things that maybe problems that need to be solved. You're going to notice opportunities in front of you. And, of course, you know, you're pointing out that exercise demonstrates that we're really not we're not patient enough.
Right.
But if we really do slow down and pay attention, really remarkable things happen.
Yeah, that's totally it. All right. So the cornerstone of improvisation is this idea of yes and, that you can't start with no, you can't start with yes, you have to say yes and. Is there a moment from your life or from work where you might have normally said no, but in this case you said yes and?
So I am one of the people who says yes to almost anything and mm-hmm. usually builds on it. So it comes very naturally to me. Mm-hmm. And let me give you one quick little example that I think has been very, very powerful. I was asked to teach a session. It was when the D School at Stanford had just started. And right. I was asked to teach a session that would teach something about entrepreneurship. Mm-hmm. And so I figured, okay, what can I do in a couple of hours? So I gave the students an envelope. And in the envelope was $5. And I told them, you have $5 and 2 hours to make as much money as possible. And I knew, you know, there was at least a simple thing, right? You could have a bake sale or you could have a, you know, a lemonade stand or wash cars. I mean, you could do something with $5. You could buy some materials. I think you could do something. Well, the things people did totally blew my socks off, right? Mm-hmm. Most of the teams realized that the $5 was a red herring. Now, just to give you a sense, they actually had a week to do this. So as soon as they opened the envelope, they had 2 hours. Mm-hmm. So they had some time to think about it and brainstorm.
Okay.
Right, so they had an envelope with $5. They knew that the next week they needed to present it. Mm-hmm. And the teams realized, oh, you know, this $5 was a red herring. And so they ended up saying, what kind of skills did they have? And they ended up making hundreds of dollars by, you know, pumping up bikes in the middle of campus, tires, mm-hmm. or getting reservations to restaurants that are really busy and then selling those reservations, or taking photos and selling them at the Viennese balls. But the team that made the most money actually sold their presentation time in class to a company that wanted to recruit those students for, and they sold it for $600. But here's the yes and piece. Uh-huh. I could have just kept doing that project. And interestingly enough, people who've read about it use this in their classes all over the world. It's mm-hmm. like the 500 rupee project or the how many, you know, euro project. Okay? But I never did it again because the next time I said, well, I already know the answer to that. I know what things people do. The next time I did it, I gave them a handful full of paper clips.
Mm-hmm.
And the next time I gave them a bunch of water bottles. And the next time I gave them, you know, each time I gave them something totally different that I really had no idea what they would do. And this ended up taking off, and I ended up taking it again, yes, and. I said, okay, we don't have to just do it in the classroom. let's do it as a project across the entire university during Entrepreneurship Week. Mm-hmm. And that worked out. So the next year I said, let's take it to global, you know, take it globally. So this project ended up growing from a little classroom project into something that we ran for years as a global innovation tournament all over the world. Wow. And the thing that's so wonderful is that I have now seen that with this type of very, very simple intervention, you can take people in places of the world where they don't feel they're creative, and with just a little tiny instruction, allow them to unleash this incredible creativity.
That's a great story. Tina Seelig, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you so much.
Well, I've been working in a coal mine.